Kevin, welcome back. Thank you so much for being here again with us today. It's an honor.
Thank you so much, Emma, for having me back.
Absolutely. These talks have been so valuable. There's things that aren't talked about enough for obvious reasons that you've stated the last two episodes, but I think your story and your own personal story, along with what you've uncovered in your research and your own whistleblowing and advocacy work, it really ties together a plethora of different sort of networks that almost get talked about separately. For example, the abuse at residential schools, that's usually very separate from, say, something like mind control, which we're going to dive into a little bit more today, which is also a little bit different than the child trafficking talks that go on a lot. And I think what you've been able to do through actually being there for different survivors, listening to their stories, digging deeper and researching, you've really been able to uncover and connect a lot of dots that bring these things together and show a broader picture. So I'm really excited to dive into that today. And I wanted to start by asking you, again, your work parallels the topic that we're going to be diving into a little bit more today, mind control. And in the intro, I covered a couple different things that do parallel, such as some of the abuse methods that were used on these children. But I wanted to ask you, when did you start to piece together that this that what you were uncovering at these residential schools seemed experimental, seemed different than maybe some abuses that you'd have heard of? And did certain survivors ever, I guess, parallel through what they disclosed to you, things along with mind control, such as having dissociation and some of the commonalities that MKUltra survivors have had?
Well, it really began the very first survivor I ever spoke to. And this wasn't just in Port Alberni, it preceded that because I did a lot of community work in Vancouver. Back in the 1980s, when I was at university, I paid my way through by working in the psych ward on the campus and in community mental health. So I worked in halfway homes and everything. So I had a lot of contact with people who had been through these experiments, right? And who were dissociated, had all the symptoms of people who had been worked on. And so, in a way, I was kind of like with other things, I was almost pre-adapted to once I went to Port Alberni to be able to recognize these signs right away. Because, as you say, when there's a huge societal crime, it's always cut up into little pieces and separated so nobody can understand the nature of the beast behind it all. They just looked at the little parts. They talk about residential schools as a separate issue, and trauma-based mind control. They're all out there. But the point is, what we found over the years by staying at this campaign is that they're all integrated. And it came out of a post-World War II culture, which was helped by the Cold War, because the early mind control experiments were justified by saying, the Russians and the North Koreans are doing this to prisoners of war. We have to understand mind control to counter that. In fact, a lot of the early mind control research were pioneered by the Nazis, based on earlier work done in America by psychiatrists, actually in the 19th century. And the basic underlying question is, how do you control the population? How does a few people control the many? Now, of course, over the centuries, there have been a lot of means to do that, right? Through intimidation, violence, often that's the best way to keep people in line, the threat of violence. But it became much more sophisticated based on the Nazi research. And it took off, as you know, in the 1950s with the MKUltra research. And the best fronts they operated behind were hospitals and churches. So, for example, we learned early on that Native children and other children in institutions, prisoners, military personnel, were on the front line of people who were being used in these experiments. In terms of, the specific aspect that you mentioned about the so-called residential schools, the very first person who ever spoke to me described, being taken into a padded cell and getting electric shocks to their head. And they said this happened. It was in the first week, actually, I began to interview survivors. His name was Kenny Quatel. And he was a native man from northern Vancouver Island. And he said he was kept in the Nanaimo Indian Hospital for several years. His parents had been told he had died on the operating table because he had spinal bifida. And they took him in, kept him in a padded cell, experimented on him. And the way he described it, of course, people have kind of recollection problems unless they're under hypnosis or find ways of kind of recalling the deep trauma. But, you know, he said the things he was describing were all the classic experiments and methods they use to probe the kind of the nature of human consciousness and how you can control it. And it's interesting because another person who was held in these Indian hospitals, and I'll talk about them in a minute, what they were created under special legislation whereby the church and the military operated these experimental centers together, the Catholics, the Anglicans, and especially the United Church that I was in. But, you know, this other woman said was that when they were being held in these facilities, there was doctors there who didn't speak English and they needed translators. And she was this woman, one of the women who was held there, Virginia Baptiste, she said that when she was a child there in the 50s, she looked and one of the doctors had a tattoo right there with funny numbers on it. Well, that's all the SS were given a branded there with a tattoo. And we actually, from other witnesses in these Indian hospitals across the country, we were able to match some of these tattoos and numbers with records from Europe of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, a very extensive center in Vienna where they have the names and the numbers of all the SS. And it was a guy called Hans Lehmann. He was a SS doctor who worked in Auschwitz with Josef Mengele in a lot of these early mind control experiments. Now, I began running across all these people as soon as I began to do this work. And it showed me early on that this wasn't simply a place which was the cover story, and it still is, a place to, you know, assimilate Native children into white culture, right, and give them an education. That's all a cover story. These were experimental and killing centers. And so that was apparent to me early on, but it's still not known to the general populace because they don't have that sense of really what's behind all of this, right?
100%. And that was when I was watching your documentary, studying the work that you've done, and really looking into some of the interviews where you've explained some of this abuse, not to mention on your documentary, Unrepented, you bring on tons of victims who are survivors now who explain some of their abuses. And you just think, you know, this isn't just taking a paddle and spanking a kid like what you'd maybe picture in a school setting. You know, some of those really old school abuses were really disgusting that they used to do on children back in the day. You know, that's, I think, what people expect when you hear about an abuse happening in a school. But you read about and listen to these survivors and listen to what you've been told through all these disclosures. These were really heinous things that they were doing to these kids. Even in your documentary, you talk about them pushing kids downstairs, putting children in rooms with sick children who had fatal diseases.
Right.
And you think, you know, this is not just, you know, spanking a kid. Like, there's something systemic happening here where these adults have to be planned what they're doing.
Well, that was the extermination aspect. They had a death quota, and this is all in murderbydecree.com. There was an annual death quota. They had to kill a certain number of children every year. And this is affirmed in letters, you know, and looking at the actual statistics over about a 60-year period, the average death rate never went down below between 40 and 60%. Now, to give a sense of perspective, in Auschwitz and Treblinka, which were work camps as well as extermination centers, the average death rate was about 25%. So we're talking double that. So these are outright extermination, but in the course of doing that, you know, they also were perfecting mind control techniques. And, you know, there was, in a way, it's inherent in these institutions that you got to get all the kids conformed and thinking in a certain way. And people often do that from terror, but, you know, just simply by being terrorized. But there's more sophisticated methods they began to perfect. And I'll give you an example. There was I mentioned these Indian hospitals. They were set up by special legislation where the churches would bring in their missionary doctors. And because churches are above the law, they're in their own jurisdiction, they could do whatever they wanted with these children. So there's this photo of these three, there were four of them actually, who ran away from a Catholic hospital up in northern BC. It was called the Leject School, but it had what they called a clinic attached to it. In fact, what they were doing, there were pain threshold experiments. And you remember in stories of Auschwitz, they would take prisoners and just take them naked and throw them out into the snow to see how long they would be able to live, to get, to perfect methods whereby the military could protect their soldiers better in winter, right? What are the limits of the human body to cold? Well, that's what happened to these four kids. They were found dead, naked in their underwear in the middle of winter, January 1937. Okay. Note the date. At the same hospital, there were German-speaking doctors operating. This is before World War II, not after. This is not Project Paperclip. Canada had a joint agreement with Nazi Germany in chemical warfare and pain threshold experiments in the 1930s, right? They were collaborating. William Lyon Mackenzie King, the prime minister, was openly pro-Hitler. And, it's why so many Nazis were brought into Canada after the war. There was that whole kind of racist, Jew-hating culture already. And so it was a perfect medium for a lot of these experiments to happen. So the cover story created by the Canadian media who published that picture was, oh no, these children were just trying to get home in the middle of winter to see their families, and they dressed them up like this. There they are in winter clothing and everything. In fact, I've read the report of the doctor who did the initial autopsy. And he was actually, his father worked in the Alberta Residential School, was the principal. His name was Dr. Pitts. And Dr. Pitts writes a report January 4th, 1937, saying these children were found naked. There is no way we can claim that they were trying to get home. They were, literally they were found naked, dead in the snow. And 2 days later, after the official inquiry, he says the exact opposite. He said, no, they were fully clothed trying to get home to the parents. So in 2 days, the doctor, whether they put a gun in his mouth or whatever, he changes the report. And now that's still the official line in Canada. This is the only picture ever published in the Canadian mainstream showing dead children from a residential school. And it's a doctored photo. So that's coming out of, an experimental program at this Leject school to throw the kids out in the snow and see how long they live, right? By the very doctors, likely, who would then do it a few years later in Auschwitz, right? So, here's one, that's kind of one example of a pain threshold experiment. But there were also mine control experiments. And I mentioned where Kenny Quatel was in the Nanaimo-Winnie Hospital, where they held him for years in this padded cell. One of the women who was there, her name was Ethel Wilson, and she was held in the same hospital. She sat down with us outside the Nanaimo-Winnie Hospital grounds, and it's all a military ground. It's a former military base. So, it could be controlled. And nobody allowed in. She drew a picture. She sat down with a psychic investigator and described what she remembers. And she drew a picture of a human head, and there were these probes going up the nostril into the midbrain area. And the psychic, and this is a psychic investigator who's used regularly by the police on Vancouver Island to find missing people. Her name was Yvonne. She came with us to the first dig we did in the Brentford School, where we found the bones. She literally pointed out where to dig and we found them. So she's very adept at this stuff. And anyway, she did the reading and she said, oh yeah, they were inserting things into the midbrain area to separate the ganglia and the brain to isolate critical thinking. They were trying to create, and she, when you look at the notes, she was scribbling down the stuff and she said, they wanted to create the perfect slave. Like it was robot creation. So, You create people who are able to function, but they don't have critical reasoning. They don't have the ability to act on anything. They just obey orders. And that was part of these surgical techniques to do that in the Nanaimo-Winnie Hospital. Now, the year after we made this stuff public, the government sealed all Indian hospital records, officially sealed them, so you can't see them anymore. The National Archives in Ottawa and everything closed down in 1999. Right, the year after our tribunal. Well, actually, not even 6 months after we went public with this. So, they've obviously got a lot in there to hide. But she was very clear that Yvonne, from the reading she got, that this is part of a huge experimental program. And in fact, another woman, Gail Perkins, who I interviewed on one of the Gulf Islands in off the BC coast. She had been held in an experimental program at the Lincoln Park Air Force Base in Calgary, again run by the United Church, the federal government, the Canadian military. And she saw this Heinz Lehmann there. That's the guy with that SS tattoo. And she was part of a group of 20 children who were all tortured to death by this guy. And they wanted her, and he kind of used her. They keep one child alive as a control element. They can study over the years to see how well the condition it takes. And that was what happened to Gail. And he kind of treated her like a little mascot. And he was describing to her everything going on. He said, "We're seeing how far, how much pain the human body can take before it shuts down. This is, has military applications, right?" And so he drew a direct connection between the Canadian military. He was operating under a Royal Canadian Air Force cover by the name Major Bob Armstrong. And that was, in fact, confirmed. The Canadian government came to them. She and her husband tried to sue the Canadian government for compensation for what she'd suffered there. This guy, Sergeant Dan Gasso from the Military Intelligence Service in Ottawa, comes out, interviews her, and says, "I've looked up all the files. This Bob Armstrong was a Waffen SS colonel. He operated all of the mind control experiments across Canada, not just in this one place. He was in charge of the whole thing." And he then goes back, like, this guy really believed in her case and wanted to fight for her. A week later, they get a phone call from him and says, "We never had this conversation. I never spoke to you. If you try to pursue this, you're going to go to jail." And that was it. Turned off quick. And so, you know, that's always a good sign that you're onto something when these things happen. But I mean, that's a taste of what, you know, some of what we, you know, what we've learned over going into the so-called residential schools. It's part of a much bigger monster, right?
Absolutely. Now, in your working with survivors, hearing so many disclosures from these residential school survivors that are in Canada, did any of them ever share anything similar to MKUltra survivors, where they had programmed parts that they were discovering that they had, or they remember being deliberately dissociated? Do you remember, or have you heard anything about that through them?
Constantly. Although that, when people are in a talking circle, they don't see it as that right away. They don't understand that they're the victims of an experiment and these methods, right? But they have the same dissociative kind of reactions. There was a woman, Anne Diamond, that's her writer's name. She's a Montreal writer. She and her brother were held in the Allen Memorial Institute of Montreal, which was the major recipient of MKUltra CIA money during the 1950s and 60s. And they would bring in children. As a matter of fact, Anne tells me that she remembers being in a room where they were bringing Native children in cages, literally. And they were brought from the local reservation. The tribal council chief would literally sell these children to them off the reservation because he was the government-funded puppet chief and he did what he was told. And they were brought in cages. This, you might want to look him up, Dr. Wilder Penfield. He was a Nobel, I believe he's a laureate. He got he ran a thing called the Montreal Neurological Institute, the MNI, and he was he's the first one to develop, in brain surgery, you can stimulate parts of the brain and you'll hear memory, you hear music from your childhood, memories will come back. So he's probing the how to control the brain. And she remembers him torturing to death children on the operating table at the Allen Institute. And a lot of these Native children, he said, were being brought from these residential schools. There he is, yeah. And, you know, so it runs all through the system. And what's interesting is there was a lawsuit brought by survivors of this, of the Allen Institute. And it's exactly what happened to the Native survivors. The same cover-up, the same gag order. They said, yeah, you can have $10,000 compensation, which is the exact figure they offered Native children, set residential school survivors. So it's the same system at work. $10,000, but you're gagged. You can never talk about it. You legally indemnify the government and the hospital and the churches that did this. And that's, unfortunately, these people who are protesting, they all get sucked into the legal system, which is designed to conceal it, protect the perpetrators, and fog it from memory so that these things can continue. Because the point is, all of these things, they're all parts of the same puzzle that of what we're living under now, which is a very mind-controlled society. The techniques they tried out in these places are now applied to all of us. And I want to talk a little bit about that in a bit, about how the stages. First, it was physical, and then chemical, and now it's electronic-based mind control. And again, these Native children and others were the initial guinea pigs, but now all of us are, right?
100%. I want to talk about that too. I do want to ask you before we go on to that. You had mentioned, I brought up the YouTube video about the Canadians that are right now protesting that. Could you talk just a little bit more about that? I know you said that it's the wrong way to go about it, but it actually made some news headlines that have reached out here in America. There's actually people, it's kind of circulating, and it's kind of interesting. So it's at least bringing the awareness of the words MKUltra a little more public because it's being publicized. But you know a couple survivors that are in this protesting and trying to get this lawsuit. And do you want to talk just a little bit about what all they're trying to do?
Yeah, it's been an effort. I mean, 20 years ago, people were pushing for this and it wasn't allowed, but it's being allowed now because the big spin operation is in place. They've destroyed most of the evidence. Most of the survivors are gone. So it's safe now for the system to allow this to be talked about. And I remember that quote from that CIA training manual back in the 70s. And it says, you can't stop change, but you can guide it. You can guide a revolution. You can guide change. And the way they're guided now is to say, okay, yeah, we can't ignore the issue because then we'll look like we're concealing it. We'll talk about the issue. We'll allow a court case, but it'll be very regulated. So these folks will be allowed to talk about certain things, but it's a carbon copy of what happened with Native people. This, quote, Truth and Reconciliation Commission didn't allow talk about dead children, didn't allow you to sue anyone, couldn't use your testimony in court. The government owned your testimony. So the serial killer gets to determine what you talk about his crimes, you know. And so it's a very guided process. And at the end of the day, people will think, and this is what they're meant to think, yeah, these horrible crimes happened a long time ago. And now we're acknowledging it and we're giving compensation and we're sorry. No, we're not sorry. We apologize. And an apology under the law is to indemnify yourself, to say, I didn't do anything wrong. That's the meaning of the word if you look it up in the dictionary. An apologetic is to defend an action, not to say you're sorry. So they couch it in the frame of looking at something, but in fact, they're not. They're making it, separating it so that people can't make the connection between what happened to those people protesting and what's happening to you right now, you know, in this culture, right?
Absolutely, yes. And I do think that that's interesting that, and it's wonderful that finally there's groups of survivors actually getting together and trying to do something, even if it's not the best way to go about it, or it might not benefit them or the movement necessarily. What a time we live in where we can now connect and people are making connections and doing things as a group instead of Kathy O'Brien, you know, 25, 30 years ago, going at this by herself and not really being able to connect with people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's the very fact of people coming together is important. It's kind of like holding a protest. It's good because we have a sense of strength of numbers. But the question is, then what do you do with it? Are you asking for something from the criminal themselves? No, we're not. We're creating our own justice. And that's why it feeds into our whole discussion of common law courts. And how it has to be on your terms. So when people, your initial impulse is to not only meet together and share stories, but then hold a protest or go to the main corporate media, right, with the story. And as Sun Tzu says in The Art of War, the moment you begin to operate on the terrain of the enemy, you've lost. You might as well not do anything because you're going to lose in the sense that they will control the outcome. But we have to define for ourselves, and this is what survivors should do as soon as they meet. And I hope that coming out of the show, we can help organize survivors in that way. The first thing we should ask themselves is, forget about asking for anything. What do you want? What is justice for you? What is it going to look like? And you never hear people, I never heard people in the early talking circles say, we need money, we need compensation. Their leaders did, because the lawyers and the leaders of these people are all going to profit from it. But you never hear people talking about money and compensation, because anyone knows you can never be compensated for this. No amount of money is ever going to make up. It might help alleviate some things, but it also goes with a gag order. And the one thing you can never give up as a survivor is the ability to speak about what happened to you. And that's the first thing they do. They take away your voice. They say, you can never talk about it again. Well, that's, you know, I've known people who that happens to, and then they go kill themselves in despair because what's the point of bringing this out is then you're silenced again, right? So you don't want to re-traumatize people by silencing them again. If you were concerned about them, you know, if the system was genuinely concerned, that's the last thing they'd do. They wouldn't gag people. They'd encourage them to speak and name the names. But then when you name the names, you're implicating people in the top of the system. So, of course, then, you know, they're going to find a way to avoid that. That's why we organize internationally our own system of support, our own common law courts and assemblies. Always operate on your own terms. It's harder in the long and takes longer, but it pays off more in the long run.
Absolutely. And I know we're going to talk about that a little bit later, the solution-oriented effects of what we can all do together to combat what you're going to be talking about. And so I love that your research, again, just spans so much to where you can connect all these dots all the way to the sort of the origins of all of this and connecting these different aspects of disclosure to then the solution aspect and what can work, you know. And so I'm really excited to talk to you about that. Before we get into the history, I want to tie in your books. I wanted to bring up a few books that we had talked about that actually sort of bring these narratives together of the trauma-based mind control as well as the residential school abuse in a way that people can maybe read through fiction or nonfiction in the stories that you've wrote to have a better idea of how these things come together. So I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that.
Okay, well, you know, the basic book where you can see a lot of the strings leading to these issues documented, A Murder by Decree, the book that we wrote in response to the TRC cover-up that the government did in 2016. So this book has been out for like 10 years. It's also up online, murderbydecree.com. You can see the whole text there. And it has, you know, again, a lot of the eyewitness testimonies describing these methods. And the Indian hospitals, the Nazi connection early on in a lot of this research. So, you know, that's kind of more meat on the subject. Now, I also wrote two other things I wanted to show because I want to get this message across in other mediums. I wrote a play called The Land of No One. And this is this play has been banned twice in Canada and once in America. We tried to produce it on the west coast of Canada, and it got shut down right in production. We had the cast, we were doing rehearsals, and then boom, the local government chiefs started threatening people, and so the director and the actors dropped out of this. Then we tried it in Toronto, the same thing, and we tried it in San Francisco with the theater group there, and they initially were interested, but they said, well, you criticize vaccination, so we can't, you know, produce this. So anyway, the reason that's so, quote, controversial is it is a story about, it's only got five characters, but the protagonists are this guy called Dr. Oliver Pierpoint. He was a doctor, a white church missionary doctor who worked at the Nanaimo Indian Hospital. And his wife and daughter really never knew much about what he did. And a survivor, a Native woman called Sheila Ambrose, comes forward and starts talking and contacts him and said, you know, you did this to me. I want justice. And then there's a reporter who's a young reporter who's trying to cover the story, and he's learning all these things. And it's really, it starts as a story about what happens in one white Canadian family when the truth comes home to roost, right? And you have to deal with these things. But at the end, it's kind of evolves more into how these methods are now being used against us. And there's this conversation at the end of the play between the doctor and the reporter who's asking these naive questions. And, you know, the doctor said, well, in another 10 years, no one will be asking those questions because their thoughts will be so controlled, they won't even think about these things, right? And these are the methods that we developed, and they're very effective now in the electronic medium. And so it's no wonder some people got upset over this because, and I think one of the reasons the Native chiefs on Vancouver shut it down is one of these guys, Joe Thorne, his father was the very one who gathered up children on Vancouver Island and brought them into the Nanaimo Indian Hospital for experiments. So that hit a nerve with their family. He said, uh-oh, we can't have dad, you know, exposed here, because they got money, the chiefs, and they still do, you know, providing children for all of these drug testing things. That was a big one as well in these hospitals. All of the major drug companies, you know, that are now pushing COVID virus, and they experimented for years, committed medical genocide on generations of children in these places, right? So anyway, that's that book on the play, and maybe someday some people will have the guts to actually produce it somewhere. And the other one, of course, is kind of a short little extended short story I wrote called The Church Lady. And it's kind of written in the, I don't know if you read detective novels, but this detective is hired to find a missing Anglican churchwoman. And the more he discovers, probes who she is, he discovers that she had provided a lot of the funding for one of these other Indian hospitals, the R.W. Large Hospital in Bella Bella, which is up the coast of British Columbia. And she finds there's a Chinese connection. There's big Chinese companies using that research now to develop these mind control technologies, including through the vaccines, which inject nanoparticles in the system. And that's part of the mind control technique, because in essence, what they do is they create a five-point energy grid where the human body becomes a receiver of signals. So you literally become a component in a device to get messages unconsciously and direct your thoughts and memories and feelings and everything. So he discovers that in the course of an investigation. So I'm trying to find a way to appeal to different groups to get this message across, you know, of what we're facing today, you know?
Yeah, and you're doing an amazing job. I mean, even just reading this is Kevin's 24th book. You've just done so much. That's really amazing how many different ways, including doing podcasts, creating a documentary. You really have gone the extra mile in every single aspect possible to get this message out to every different type of person, whether they read, whether they watch podcasts, whether they'd rather watch it in a movie format, you know, and even going into the communities and actually being with survivors and helping them and going to different events and, you know, being a local champion too for the people in your own country that, you know, are suffering and haven't really had a voice. So I'm going to have all three of those books in the show notes. Of course, all Kevin's books really do tie a lot of this together, right down to the common law books, right down to the whistleblower guide that he has. You know, all of his books really tie this in, but these three specifically, if you guys want to learn and again, experience through reading different ways that trauma-based mind control is a collaborative effort with a lot of these residential school abuse strategies. Those books, I think, would be a really great way for you guys to sort of see how all of this is interconnected in so many ways. And thank you, Kevin, again, for all the work that you do. I know that this has to have just been so tireless for you. And, you know, most people haven't even written one book, much less, you know, a couple dozen. So your work, it really does stand. It stands on its own. It's going to stand the test of time. And we're all really grateful for everything that you're doing.
Well, thank you. And, you know, it's kind of like, I always have to say that none of those books would have been possible unless I met the people themselves who risked a lot more than I did. And a number of them paid with their lives for bringing this truth out. And I always honor them because all those children we don't know about who are in the ground and who are suffering now in these experiments, right? And we have an obligation, if we're going to remain human, to talk about this, that the kinds of things that, you know, people naturally don't want to hear about, but have to if you're concerned about your own children, your own lives, you know?
Absolutely, yes. And so let's get into talking about the timeline of mind control. Yeah. It's a really great way of breaking this down and helping us understand it. Because again, we do hear about it in very compartmentalized ways. And I think having the full picture of sort of the historical elements of it, as well as how it looks today, is so important for us to understand. So I'd love for you to present some of that to us and, you know, to give us sort of an idea of what you found in your research.
Well, you know, as you mentioned, some of this is available. You know, the literature on what MKUltra was and is, and how it got started and everything. As with something like eugenics, like the attempt to create a, quote, master race through sterilizations, selective breeding, all that stuff, it got started in a big way in America in the late 19th century. And the Germans and the Nazis picked it up and copied it. Although it was kind of like a cross-Atlantic phenomena happening where people were trying to figure out how do you control and create a herd that can simply be, you know, manipulated. Now, that's always been the priority of any elite bunch of elite rulers, right? How to do that. the technology to develop that really started in a big way after World War II, and that's a period that's best documented. So I want to kind of focus on that. In the early period, say from the 30s right up to the 1960s, it's stage one is like physical methods of mind control. So for example, lobotomies, that's one obvious one. Early forms of lobotomy is, they call it transorbital, where they would go in above the eyeball and stick a metal probe in and separate, you know, in the picture that the woman drew in the Nam Oni Hospital of inserting stuff into the midbrain through the nostril. They separate the frontal, you know, nerve connections here, and you lose ability critical to, you know, for critical thinking. And an infamous example of that, there was a movie made about this with Jessica Lange called Frances, F-R-A-N-C-E-S. It's about a Hollywood actress, Frances Farmer, who was in the 1930s, she was very militant. She was a political radical. She challenged the establishment in America, and she challenged the Hollywood kind of director or the, you know, the movie mogul monopoly in Hollywood. And she was seen as a troublemaker. So they set her up for an arrest. They committed her to Steilacoom, which I don't know if you saw the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest with Jack Nicholson. You should see it because it's based in Steilacoom. And that's where this guy, Dr. Jose Delgado, developed the first lobotomy techniques. They lobotomized Frances and turned her into a vegetable, basically. Could barely speak, you know, and held it up. Like kind of when you defrock somebody like they did me publicly. As an example, this is going to happen to you if you people step out of line, right? They always make it public to show, you know, to get people scared from these things. So those lobotomy techniques and hypnosis, that kind of thing, was in the early stages. But then from a lot of the Nazi researchers, there was stage two is really chemical, attempt to control the human mind and behavior through chemical means. That's from the 50s right up to the 90s. And you had things developed, and we got a lot of evidence of this, places like not only Indian hospitals attached to the residential schools, but places like the Lakehead Psychiatric Hospital in Thunder Bay, Ontario, the Allen Institute, all over America, university hospitals had these techniques, developing drugs like one was called Largactyl. It was an early version of the rape drug, where if you administer it to someone, they lose, they appear to be conscious, but they've lost the capacity to resist or to think. They become a purely functional intelligence. You go around and you're able to operate in the world, but you can't, if something happens, you can't question it or say, hey, is that right? Critical reasoning is gone, just wiped clean, boom, and you respond to orders or conditioning. And of course, a lot of people are like that anyway. We are raised to be habitual thinkers, right? So people are raised, like in a classroom, just, you know, you learn a rote thing and that's reality. And you adhere to the reality even when it doesn't make sense. And you learn to operate enough intelligence to be able to operate any day, but not to challenge things the way they are. Because you notice when you talk to your friends or family or anyone about the ideas they may not have heard about or that challenge their whole basis of how they view things, they'll just reject it. All right, that can't be. That's just impossible. Right? That's habitual thinking at work. And that's how a population is programmed anyway. But these chemicals exacerbate that. They make it so that there's no coming back. Once you're changed that way, chemically, it's hard to recover your original identity. But human biology varies a lot culturally and in other ways, and the same chemical doesn't take in the same way to everybody. So you can't just dump drugs like that in the water system and then expect everyone to be brainwashed. It never happens that way. In fact, there was another drug developed by the Nazis in Canada in the 1960s called chlorpromazine. And chlorpromazine is another one that even more effective than this early date rape drug, which just renders people into complete vegetables. They just, you know, so much that way that they can't function. So it's a crude method, chemical as well as is crude. So the most effective is what is in place now, and that's electronic. Because don't forget, not only the human brain, but we are simply energy. We are electronic waves and other kinds of energy, right? But the human brain is it operates at certain frequencies. So your memories, your of life, your feelings, your thoughts, they're all at certain wavelengths. And all the technology for the last 30 to 40 years and the research has been into how to duplicate those brainwaves and then beam them back at people, right? And you can literally induce whatever memory, whatever thought or feeling you want in people. And it works very effectively, almost 100%. Somebody who did this research early on was telling me, and they want to be anonymous, of course, but they said that there's about 2% who it doesn't take on. 98% of people it's effective, but there is 2%, and they don't know why. And I have my own theory about that. It's kind of a more of a, if you want to call it spiritual, that our souls cannot be controlled, but not all of us are in touch with our soul. In fact, most of us aren't. We're not raised in that way to have a sense of our soul identity, right? But some people are naturally inclined that way. And you find more native people are like that because they're more in touch traditionally with the source of a lot of that, like all of us once were, right? Before technology and so-called modern civilization. So 2% of it doesn't take on generally, but 98% it does. And the way it works is not only does it duplicate the certain, whatever brain frequency the people transmitting want to induce in the general population, but it induces whatever emotion they want, right? And it can only work, and that's the kind of the theory now behind what the whole COVID thing was about. It only works if you become a receptor, literally an electronic receptor. And there's a Dr. Catherine Horton, a physicist at Oxford, who went public with this stuff, and she got taken on in a major way. But before she was silenced, she developed this whole, this kind of model of the nanoparticles injected in what are called Trojan horse serums. So for example, under the guise of a public health emergency, which always works in their so-called herd study analyses of what people will respond to, a public health emergency, almost everybody responds and lines up for the shot. So that's what happened in 2020, right? Pandemic, right? And so everyone lined up, and what was, Catherine believes and others, was being injected were these nanoparticles that take up position at certain points in our, along the spinal cord here, of course, and in other parts of the body. You literally become a component then of a bigger machine that can, okay, not only, and this is the fourth stage, it isn't just having our mind and everything controlled. We are literally absorbed into a higher mind, a machine mind. We're becoming like individual brain cells in a machine mind. And the proof of that, all you have to do is look around. People below a certain age, they're all like this. Every day, they're on their iPad. And they're not only on their iPad, but I've ridden on the buses and watched carefully. None of them ever let go of it. You'd think that after a while, they put it in their bag, but they don't. They're like this. They're holding onto it. And it's usually near their chest. It's because they're setting up a symbiotic energy signal here whereby they can't live without it. So I believe in another 3 to 5 years before 2030, because that's the target date for this to be complete by, it's going to be announced that iPads are redundant. Now you can operate without any of it. And there was a movie made on this, and it showed these people, and they were sitting there like this, and all they could see on their eyes were information, because they have been integrated. Their mind, it's like creating a new organism, half man, half machine, like a cybernetic organism, where your mind and your thoughts and your energy are literally integrated into a bigger machine network, and you're operating as part of that machine mind. So no more Homo sapiens, no more Homo sapiens, we're Homo machina. We're part of a new global machine organism. And with Musk and that whole direction that's being taken, that is the aim. They're exterminating the human race and making us components of this machine. And they have the technology to do that now. It's happening as we speak. So that is kind of the four stages that I think, well, pretty clear we're leading in that direction. And it's all coming from that whole history of how you get people, not just slaves, that was the early stage, but now actually integrated so they're not people anymore. They're just components.
Right. And then going into how you said Musk, and talking about the technological side, how they really want to sort of control our DNA in a way, and our genome sequences through different things. I mean, I just read an article today that I believe the UK is going to start doing a DNA test for every single baby that's born
Right.
in the country. And I was like, I mean, they sort of do that anyways. They take blood, and there's different ways that the government has, all over the world, governments have tracks of us, whether it's our fingerprints or our records, social security numbers, whatever it is, a million IDs now that we need to have, but you really do see how it's leading that way, where they don't want to just control us with what we do, going to school and paying money and, helping fund things and sort of pushing agendas. But they want to have control of us on a cellular level too. And they're slowly rolling that in and getting us to accept that through things like cell phones and the fear shots, that they're really pushing, whether it's fear or excitement, they're getting us to buy into these things as a society. And we don't realize again how it all goes together. It all looks very separate and compartmentalized from the outside.
Yeah. So again, I mean, it's things are always further along than you realize because the technology they have is always 10 to 20 years in advance of anything we're even aware of, right? Like the military was using the internet in the 1960s. You know, they had it then, and then we didn't hear about it till the late 80s, right? So I mean, you've got to realize that, and that's why to operate. When we were talking earlier about what to do about it, to operate in the system they set up is just suicide. It's not going to lead anywhere. People need to, the more controlled you are, the more radical has to be the break from what we're part of. And that's asking a lot from most people because I don't think most people are capable of it under the present circumstances. But there is that minority that is. And in all the work now, we try to reach that minority and say, okay, we've got to be the leadership on this. We've got to recover our own minds and autonomy and then lead whoever we can out of the system because otherwise we're not going to be around. There, you know, I think in another generation or less, probably less time than that, not even a decade, we're not going to be, people will not be able to have this kind of discussion because they won't be allowed to. I mean, it simply won't be in the anymore than any of this evidence we published is out there on the internet anymore. It's just swabbed. Continually modulated and swapped. So we've got to fight that to the death, right?
100%. I couldn't agree more, Kevin. And as you were talking about sort of the, some relationships of the indigenous community and the experimentation done on them, MKUltra survivors, even Ann Diamond's testimony, it brought to mind to me too, which I thought was worth mentioning, that I've had actually a bunch of survivors on my show who say that them having some type of Indian bloodline was a reason that they were chosen for the programming and that their parents were, and that these indigenous tribes are supposed to have higher propensities for psychic abilities, and sort of how you were saying, just a different spiritual culture that they embody. And I thought that that was kind of interesting too, because, when we think about which sort of populations that we've seen experimented on, that we've seen genocided, that we've seen targeted, it's not ever just random. There's always reasons why they want to do it, and I thought that was kind of an interesting tie-in that I've heard from a lot of survivors.
Yeah, and it isn't unique to Native people today. It was once inherent in all of us, and that's you know, I think I mentioned once before that the electronic frequency of the Earth is the same as that in the human brain. It's a very low frequency, but we're tied in. We're literally our minds are one with Mother Earth, and you know that when you go out in the real countryside and lie on the Earth for half an hour, you're fine. You know, things are feeling really good, right? Like we're in harmony again, right? And that's what I urge. The first thing people need to do is turn off everything and go and do that. Get out in nature, stand by a waterfall. It's so beautiful just to be yourself again, right? And that's the first step of recovery. And, you know, and so Native people, yeah, have been closer to that, but that's why they were targeted so badly. And it's like when the Romans invaded England, the first thing they did in the early times. They killed all the Druids. They massacred every Druid they could find because they were the spiritual elders and the leaders, and they were in touch with their long traditions, right? That kept them safe at a basic level from these foreign invaders, right? and control. So there's so much weighing against that happening to us once we've been raised in this culture. We don't even know. And I give a little anecdote about that. One of the things I found out is after World War II, the British went through all of their files from the colonial era, and they brought in this thing called legacy files. So they took out anything that refers to a crime by a crown official, and they substituted it with another file, which rewrote the history and said, no, you know, all these people weren't killed, some were harmed, but they continually created a substitute history all along to make it seem like things were better. Now, that's a really common method now, but it's almost as if within every mind, they're doing the same thing. They're creating a legacy file in every mind of, no, here's the reality. Children weren't harmed. They weren't experimented on. You know, right now in downtown Vancouver, they have a big Indigenous celebration day, but the very people who killed the children are sponsoring it, the churches. And the United Church is building a big new high rise. You know, they got lots of money. So a bunch of people stood there with a sign, genocide pays. The United Church is profiting, never went to jail, and look at all the money they got, right? And they're sponsoring these Indigenous days. So it's like, that's the file they're putting in people's minds now. Well, we didn't really do anything wrong, you know? They're really nice people. And, you know, so that substitute narrative is always there. And we have to continually just say, no, here's the evidence, here's the real truth, right?
Yes, that's really, I mean, disgusting in a lot of ways. And it shows how long this has been going on, to where today's generation that would go support an event like this without doing research on the history or listening to somebody like you, they don't make that connection that, oh, the same people sponsoring this are responsible for it. They just look at it like a sponsor and don't understand historically what's going on.
Right. Yeah, and there's another, in one of my books, I talk about this thing called panopticon. It's a really important thing. There was this guy in the 1800s, Jerome Bentham. He was a philosopher in England, and he created this model prison called a panopticon. The panopticon means all-seeing eye. And he said the way you control a population is you don't do it overtly. You get people to regulate themselves, and people will obey and do what the system wants them to do if they think they're being watched. So Jeremy Bentham designed this prison where there's a central tower and all the prison cells face inward in a big circle, and all the prisoners know they're being watched. And so they literally lock themselves in at night and they go along with the rules, not because there's a guard there with a club, but because there's a guard in their own head saying, obey, I'm being watched all the time. Well, look at any street corner. How many cameras are there watching us, right? The all-seeing eye is there. It's been institutionalized, and we're living in one big panopticon prison. And it's no accident the Masonic symbol of the all-seeing eye, or the eye in the American dollar bill traditionally, right? The all-seeing eye keeping their big brothers watching you at all times. And so that's the culture. People control themselves. They don't have to be told what to do. Everyone regulates themselves so that they don't get in trouble, because they might get hurt. Now, if you say to people, well, who's going to hurt you? Why would you be hurt? They can't answer that. It's just a fear, right? And it's a permanent state of fear created by the way society is set up. I mean, I remember in the 70s when they first brought in cameras in downtown Vancouver, people were smashing them. They were painting over them. People are angry. I'm not going to be monitored by some bloody camera. And then you get used to it, because where else can you go, right? And people, a new generation, it's normal to be camera. Oh, they're just watching and taking care of us, you know? The slavery is so institutionalized, and when you're raised in it, you got to have somebody to say, wait a minute, you know, use common sense here, people. Why are you being watched?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you even see it on social media. People are documenting their lives. They're taping themselves so everybody can see them on every platform, making videos, documenting their lives, showing where they're at, what they're doing, who they're hanging out with, you know? So it's almost like they're getting us used to it that way too, through our electronics. Like you said, we're so connected to them that, like, we don't even see the danger of the world outside of us because we're so connected on here and it all looks safe.
And here's the thing, Emma, here's the good side of this. Jeremy Bentham, when he did the panopticon prison, he said, you could apply this model to government, to city planning, to policing, prison, whatever. It's a way to get people to regulate themselves. But it didn't work. He did a study and he found it didn't work when the prisoners would ignore the central tower and just start talking to each other. He said in those prisons where they had their own communities, They forgot about the panopticon, and they were more free. So that's a clue to us. If we forget about the all-seeing eye watching us at all times and put away our devices and just start having normal contact, the feared lessons, because we have each other. You know, we have that, and we find that exactly the same thing happens in our assemblies. When people, the more community projects they do together, it could just be planting a garden, or it could be doing something where we have contact with each other. That's our best antidote to mind control. When, and that's the way support groups happen. You sit in a circle and you support each other, right? In the most basic square one thing. So the panopticon can be fought. It isn't all powerful. They just want you to think they're all powerful when they're not.